From the Center for Investigative Reporting in PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. The mid-coast of Maine is full of pine forests, sleepy harbors, and craggy beaches. For Charlie Wing, this part of the state is a place of easy summers and cold winters. Charlie's standing on a beach, looking out at an old pier and a lifeguard station. In the distance, lobster boats are prowling the mouth of the Kennebec River. Charlie remembers one blustery September afternoon when he and his son Chaz drove here.
It was storming that day, and it was colder than this. You know, it was not exactly a nice day, but this place has always kind of calmed me, and it seemed at the time like there was a storm inside Chaz, and I just wanted to try to talk to him and find out what was going on.
It was 2012. Chaz was 13, just starting eighth grade and in crisis. He was barely passing his classes, and he was talking about suicide. Charlie knew other kids were bullying his son at school, but not a lot more than that.
We started walking, and I just couldn't quite get... I didn't understand the depth of what had been happening to him. I was like, well, they're bullies. You got to stand up to them. You know, I've been bullied, and I was trying to give him the father-son. You know, you just got to be a man and stand up to them. And he was like, hmm.
Charlie and Chaz slowly made their way up the beach.
And I didn't feel like I was getting anywhere with him.
After about a mile, they turned around. Then Chaz stopped in the sand.
Yes, standing there looking out at the water and the waves and the wind coming at him and stuff. And he said, do you mind if I go in the water? And I wasn't sure what I thought because he'd threatened to commit suicide several times.
Chaz rolled up his pants, took off his shoes and socks, and placed them neatly on the beach. His father stared after him, wondering if he'd have to rescue his son.
He walked out, kind of up to his knees, and he started, like, yelling at the sky, listen to me, listen to me. And I didn't know what it meant, but he said it four or five times. All I understood was I think that I'm dealing with a problem that's larger than I really understand. At the time, I just didn't know. At the time, I didn't know there had been a sexual assault.
Before we go any further, you should know that's what our show is about today. Sexual assault among school kids. It's an issue that isn't appropriate for all listeners. Often, when you hear about students being abused at school, it involves adults, teachers, coaches, or other staff. But our partners at the Associated Press spent more than a year investigating these cases, and they uncovered something surprising. For every one child abused by an adult at school, seven are abused by their peers. And it's a problem that extends to the U.S. military. Since we first aired this investigation last year, the AP found hundreds of cases of kids who were sexually assaulted by other kids at military bases. Many were overlooked or ignored by the authorities. We'll get to that later in the show. But first, the story of Chaz Wing. Like many people, he hid his abuse and pain for a long time. It's hard to talk about. But he opened up to Associated Press reporter Robin McDowell, and she brings us his story.
From his first days at Brunswick Junior High School, Chaz remembers being bullied. He tells me boys would corner him at his locker, taunt him. In the halls, they'd bump him. In class, they'd play jokes.
I think they picked on me because of my weight, the type of music I listened to, my interests, the way I acted. Anything that wasn't completely cookie cutter, a middle school boy attitude.
Chaz is 18 now, but he's always been a quirky kid. His dark brown mullet hangs to his shoulders. He collects old records, cassettes, 8-track tapes. Instead of sports and video games, he started an analog club at school.
He's an interesting kid.
This is his mother, Amy, blonde, blue-eyed. She's a nurse who's passionate about her work and her two sons. She split up with Charlie when Chaz was in the fifth grade. She says when Chaz entered junior high, he was considered gifted and talented. Within a year, though, his grades started slipping, and he'd come home feeling confused and upset.
Why are the kids mean? Why are they mean to me? At first, I was like, well, you know, they have problems at home. They're just picking on you to make themselves feel better. If you ignore them, they'll stop.
Chaz tried to ignore the bullying, but it got a lot more personal.
There was the thing that they called the gay test. Can you tell me about it?
The gay test was when they lightly put their hand on your shoulder, and if you didn't notice it and bat it away in under 10 seconds, they would declare that you are gay, and you must have enjoyed it, and that's why you didn't knock their hand away. It was very uncomfortable. I definitely had to watch over my shoulder quite a bit. It would happen inside and out of school, and I didn't feel like I had any privacy.
Like a lot of schools around the country, Brunswick Junior High had a policy against bullying. Chaz remembers anti-bullying assemblies and posters. If you see something, say something. So he did. He complained so many times, some teachers labeled him a nuisance. The bullying got so bad, his mom Amy says she marched into Principal Walter Wallace's office several times. He told her he'd speak to the boys and their parents.
At first, he seemed like he was interested. I trusted that he would follow through and look into everything. You know, they kept saying that they were handling it.
Amy says Wallace didn't live up to his promises.
It's so beautiful, and just the salt air, something about the sea.
Ever since he was a kid, Charlie Wing liked coming here to Popham Beach. It's a half-hour drive from Brunswick.
I don't mind getting a little bit wet.
Charlie Wing looks like a biker with a graying, shaggy beard. He works at a big retailer and dresses like a drummer in a rock band. That's what he does for fun. On a blustery September day when he brought Chaz here, Charlie says it felt like a movie.
And we're getting blasted in the face with a little bit of rain and him just yelling at the wind, you know, yelling out at the furies of the powers that be, I suppose, you know. I'll never forget that. I'll never, just that this is a big deal and I need to really start paying more attention.
Chaz didn't tell his dad anything then, but he was about to open up. It started after Amy met with a group of his teachers. Chaz was refusing to go to school. The teachers wanted to get him back into class. But they told Amy that Chaz needed to meet with them. So she headed home and told him.
And he said, no, I can't go. I said, Chaz, you have to. They want you to be at that meeting. And he grabbed the pillow on the bed and started holding it and was rocking back and forth. And he said, no, I can't go. And I said, you have to. And he said, Mom, no, I can't. They're going to hurt me. And I said, Chaz, you have to tell me what is going on. And he just kept saying, they're going to hurt me. They hurt me. I can't go back. And finally, I told him, I said, if you don't tell me, I can't help you. We can't fix this. I need to know what's going on. You have to tell me. And that's when he told me, started telling me everything.
Chaz told Amy something had happened to him at school, back in the seventh grade. He says some of the same boys who'd been bullying him sexually assaulted him. Later, Chaz gave more details under oath. He said some boys grabbed him in a school bathroom and raped him three different times. Chaz told me he didn't talk about this with anyone for months because he was ashamed and afraid.
They threatened to hurt my family and pets. They threatened to hurt me. They cut my arm, which I still have a scar from. They threatened to burn our house down.
On the one hand, it all made sense. On the other hand, I didn't want to believe it. I couldn't believe it. I had never in a million years thought school was where it was.
Amy Wing reported to the school what Chaz told her about the sexual assaults. Principal Wallace led an investigation but left the job of interviewing Chaz to his vice principal. The Brunswick police also investigated. The man in charge, he was also the school resource officer at Brunswick Junior High. If Chaz was telling the truth, then the assaults happened on their watch. The investigations wrapped up in about a month. The Brunswick Police Department and the school district determined there was no credible evidence to support Chaz's allegations, even though a state psychologist found strong evidence that Chaz was sexually abused.
I don't think people want to believe it happens, that sexual assault happens amongst children.
Courtney Beer is someone Amy Wing turned to for help. She's a staff attorney with Pine Tree, a nonprofit that offers free legal aid.
I just don't think people want to acknowledge that it exists. And the discouraging part is that there is no way to track the numbers.
Courtney says she believes Chaz was telling the truth. It became more real to her when she walked through Brunswick Junior High with him as she looked into the case.
You could see Chaz's raw sense of emotion when he had to walk into the bathrooms where the assaults had occurred. And memories were coming back to him as he walked through the school, and he was disclosing details that he had not reported previously because he was remembering them as we were there.
In 2015, the Wings filed a lawsuit claiming the district had violated Chaz's civil rights by not doing enough to stop the bullying and abuse. The state's Human Rights Commission joined them. School officials wouldn't talk to us, but they had to talk to Chaz's lawyers. We obtained hours of video depositions that were part of the lawsuit.
Yes. Good morning again, Mr. Wallace. Could you spell your full name for the record?
Walter Wallace, W-A-L-T-E-R.
In one deposition, attorney David Webert questions Principal Walter Wallace. He says other kids did bully Chaz from time to time, and the school dealt with it. He also says he couldn't verify a lot of what Chaz had to say.
Well, there were a lot of reports about things that we could not substantiate. There was this hypersensitivity to any look, any movement, any rushing in the hallway.
He tells the court that some of Chaz's problems with other students were his own fault.
Chaz is very opinionated. He likes what he likes. If you don't agree with him on things, he gets irritated with you. There's some arrogance.
Then they get into the sexual assault allegations. Wallace said he had trouble believing Chaz's story because he didn't think the attacks could have happened in the small bathroom stalls. And he believed what the other boys had to say.
One student's reaction was the student had no idea what even we were talking about. He had no frame of reference for anal sex. He was bewildered. He was confused. The other students immediately were shaking their head. No, that never happened. I wouldn't do that. Why would I do that?
Did you ever interview Chaz Wing about his allegations of sexual assault?
I did not.
In hindsight, should you have spoken directly to Chaz Wing?
I could have. I don't. I was confident in the notes that were taken. This was a sensitive case. We were trying to do this as quickly and as efficiently and complete as possible.
Did you ever go back to Chaz Wing with any of the information you obtained in the interviews to ask him to explain your concerns about plausibility or credibility of his allegations?
No.
Did you consider doing that?
Not that I remember.
There's something else Walter Wallace didn't do. He never made a written report. He just told the school superintendent about his findings.
Did you write any of this down?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Was this an important judgment you were making?
Sure.
In hindsight, should you have written your analysis down?
I think it would be helpful right now.
And could you start by telling us your name?
Chaz Wing, or Charles Wing.
In his deposition, Chaz wears a black dress shirt and gray tie. He looks composed. Attorney Melissa Huey questions him for 8 hours over 2 days. At one point, she brings up the times other boys would gently touch his shoulder, the so-called gay test.
And why were you concerned that people might think you were gay?
Because it was taboo. It was frowned upon by the majority of students at the school there.
Attorney Courtney Beer attended many of the depositions.
It certainly felt to me that the district was seeking to somehow blame him for his involvement and for part of what happened. His sexuality was a topic of question, and that was something that the teachers had also asked him when he was in school as to whether or not he was gay, and if he wasn't, then why would it really matter if he was being called gay?
Do you recall complaining to anybody at Brunswick Junior High School that two male students told you, "I love you"?
Yes.
Do you remember whether you were offended by that or not?
I was.
Why would you be offended by that?
Objection. The tone of voice is really out of touch with reality.
You can't object to tone of voice.
Yes, I can.
Can you answer my question?
You're not supposed to be... You ask questions, you don't comment on answers. And your suggestion is contrary to the way the world works, and so I don't understand how you could have a good faith basis for suggesting that a middle school boy is not going to be upset by that comment.
Could you please repeat the question?
Why did it upset you that someone said, "I love you"?
Because I did not think it was appropriate for another male student to love me. I didn't see any reason for them to say they loved me.
Later, I asked Chaz if he thought the way the attorney questioned him felt like another kind of gay test.
Yes. Yes, definitely. I believe they were trying to solicit a more aggressive, angry response from me, trying to make me seem belligerent.
The school's attorney spends hours taking Chaz through each alleged assault in graphic detail. He describes how, on one occasion, two boys held him in the bathroom stall and raped him.
Okay. Then what happened?
I cleaned myself up, and I went back to class.
You went out to class?
Mm-hmm.
Did you tell anyone about this?
No.
And why not?
Because I was afraid that I would be in danger if I did.
After the depositions wrapped up, Chaz and his family felt a rush of emotions. It was painful for them to relive all the things Chaz says he went through. They were angry. Chaz says he also felt some relief that it was almost over. Within a few weeks, the two sides moved toward a settlement. The district agreed to pay $125,000. After legal fees, Chaz got $50,000. The district also promised to improve the way it tracks allegations of bullying. But what Chaz wanted most of all was an apology from the school district. There would be none.
We're going to follow this road all the way to the end of it.
Recently, I took a drive around Brunswick with Chaz. It's an old mill town, population 20,000.
Down to the right is the back way to get to the Goodwill. One of my favorite places to go shopping.
We pass the weekend flea market, where he sells some of the old electronics he collects. Back at home, Chaz leads me down into his basement. It's packed with stuff he's collected since he was little. Stuff he can't seem to let go of.
Got the Selectivision RCA VCR here. I have a Betamax VCR there, a CED player. This is where everything that's too good for the flea market stays. Everything I want to keep in my own collection. So that is a 1924 RCA with photophone audio capabilities. I like preserving the history. I like being able to access any tape, any disc that comes my way, be able to see what's on it, not just be left wondering, could this be footage of my parents or grandparents taking their first steps.
To Chaz, being able to tell a story that was trapped inside him is a bit like bringing these flickering images back to life. Now he just wants to move on. He says he might stay in Brunswick and find a job, or go away to college. Sometimes he just wants to hop on a bicycle and ride all the way down to Florida, where his grandparents live. Chaz says he hopes his decision to go public will help others who face bullying and sexual violence in school. He says he'd be willing to forgive the boys if they apologized to him. He doesn't feel that way about the Brunswick school officials.
They are all adults. They know full well what their actions mean. And one of their jobs is protecting the students. They were accepting taxpayer money for something they weren't doing. I don't think that they should still be in charge of a school district.
Out to the Brunswick School District. They wouldn't talk to us, but just before we wrapped up the story, the attorney for the school district, Lissa Huey, sent the Associated Press a statement. In it, she said one reason the district settled was to protect the boys that Chaz accused from a public trial. She called them the real victims. Thanks to the Associated Press's Robin McDowell for that story. It was produced by Michael Montgomery. When we come back, we'll look at sexual assault among kids on military bases and why the world's most powerful fighting force is unable to defend them or their families.
You send your children to school and think they'll be safe and taken care of, and this is like my worst nightmare come true.
You're listening to Reveal.
Reveal is supported by the all-new Simply Safe. Simply Safe's brand new system is smaller, faster, stronger than ever before. Completely rebuilt and redesigned with new safeguards against power outages, downed Wi-Fi, cut landlines, bats, hammers, and everything in between. It's the first security system that you might actually call beautiful. You should check it out. And what's remarkable? You still get 24/7 protection for only $15 a month and no contract. But supplies are limited. Visit simplysafe.com/reveal.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. We're revisiting an investigation from last year that deals with child sexual assault, an important topic, but one that isn't for all listeners. Our partners at the Associated Press found 17,000 official reports of sexual assault by kids on other kids at U.S. schools over a four-year period. And like the story of Chaz Wing, they uncovered a widespread failure to deal with the abuse. Now, the AP didn't stop there. Just this week, they published a new investigation looking at this problem on U.S. military bases. Those reporters are with me now, Justin Pritchard and Reese Dunklin. So, Reese, this investigation is really hard to take in. I mean, I've got two kids in school. I know you and Justin each have kids. I don't think I even thought about these type of assaults happening, at least not on the scale that you guys reported on.
I don't know that many parents do. I certainly didn't prior to this. And one thing you have to remember is we were looking at cases that are happening on school campuses or under the school supervision. And we are also looking at cases that are severe. This is rape, sodomy, groping. We are not counting cases where it's consensual sex among teens, or it's a little kindergartner who incidentally touches a classmate. These are tough cases.
So, Justin, your new investigation looks at the situation on military installations. What led you there?
It was really reader feedback to the first series that we looked into. You know, what you learn is that these bases are like small cities. They have neighborhoods, they have schools, they have teen centers and playgrounds, and they're described, they're really well thought of as their own ecosystems and their own places, and at the same time, they're a microcosm of broader society, and that means there's both good and bad things happening on them. What's different, though, is how things are handled.
So you found reports of hundreds of sexual assaults among children and teens, many that were never prosecuted, even when the attacker confessed. Now, how is that possible?
Military bases and service members on military bases are subject to military law. Their family members are subject to civilian law. What you have, though, is many of these bases are what's called federal jurisdiction, so the U.S. Department of Justice would take the lead on any prosecution. And what we found is, essentially, they are not interested in these types of prosecutions. They want bigger cases, perhaps something more like busting up a gang or public corruption or something like this. A sex assault case is really something that would be dealt with on the state level by a junior district attorney. And when you're overseas, there's really not an option to try and get a case to local prosecutors. That's not something American officials want to do, to give a case of American-on-American children sexual assault to a Japanese prosecutor or a German prosecutor.
And the other thing you have to remember is the roughly 600 cases we found, that's just the tip of the iceberg. We don't know what the ceiling is on this. We asked the Department of Defense if it knew the extent of the problem, and it didn't. The information it initially shared with us omitted a third of those 600 cases that we were able to identify. And later on, through our reporting, we learned that that the military had other reports that were missing from what we received.
Reese, one of your stories focuses on like a half a dozen first grade girls who were repeatedly assaulted by a boy in their class at a school on a military base, and yet the school and the military didn't do much about it.
That's right, Al. Recently, I went to Colorado to visit the family of one of the girls.
Hey, how are you?
We're not naming the families to protect the identities of their daughters. But when I sat down with these parents, it was because they really wanted to get this story out.
If your food is downstairs, then all the noise will stay up here.
Okay. The father took care of their infant son while the mother and I sat on the couch in their basement, and she opened up about what they went through.
You send your children to school and think they'll be safe and taken care of and someone's looking out for them. And this is like my worst nightmare come true.
The case goes back about 3 years to an army base in Germany. The father had been deployed there, and the family was excited to go. They really wanted to be in Europe, and they liked the potential of the school and the academics it offered their daughter. And for the most part, the school year seemed ordinary. They did notice that their daughter acted a little more temperamental after Christmas, but they chalked that up to homesickness. And then one afternoon in late July 2015, the mother was watching a TV crime drama with her daughter playing nearby, and someone on the crime drama mentioned sex in the context of gender. Yet the daughter stopped and giggled, and that worried the mother that the daughter would even know what the word sex meant. So she decided to try to figure out why the daughter had that reaction, and so she asked later on, had anyone inappropriately touched you? And the girl reacted as though she was having a panic attack.
She seemed very shameful. First, she just said, well, this person touched me. And it took me a second to really process what she said. And then I had to slowly dig out further details and see what this touching really was and how heinous it really was. It was pretty terrible.
I can't even imagine what it must be like to be a parent and have to have that conversation with your child. So you're going to tell us what happened, but we should warn our listeners that this is pretty hard to hear.
The girl confided in her mother that several times a week during the school year, the boy had either forced kisses on her, had coaxed her to touch him, or even penetrated her with his finger under the clothes. And this was happening in class, it was happening on the playground. And he told her she would get hurt if she told anyone. And the mother said she was completely terrified. And the daughter also said that she wasn't the only girl. There were other ones who were abused.
So what'd the family do next?
Well, later that night, the mother decided to contact some of the other families just to see what they knew, and they didn't know anything either. So she had the awkward situation of breaking the news to those families. The day after that, they decided to start working their way through the military's vast support system, the sexual abuse response offices, criminal investigators to file a report, the school. And the long and short is not a lot got done. They didn't get a lot of help.
Cerise, you write that the principal actually knew what was going on.
Yes, the mother said she had made contact with yet another family, and that family had told her, to her surprise, that the principal had actually contacted them months earlier and reported incidents between the boy and their daughter. And after the second call, that family pressed their own daughter for more details, and they discovered it was the same sort of severe contact, and also that other girls were involved. So that father was fuming, and he called the principal back, and he passed along the names of the other girls, including that of the parents now in Colorado. And yet no one from the school called her.
That would have never, like, in a million years would I think that my child's sexual assault wouldn't be taken seriously. And that it was, oh, kids will be kids and just have door after door shut in our face. It, especially so young, being a six-year-old, being victimized in this way.
The boy at the center of the allegations did not return to the girl's school, but her family had to remain in Germany until the following year, when the father was reassigned to a base in Colorado.
You know, everyone is recovering. They struggle with a lack of closure, and they have reminders of what happened in their lives. The daughter is starting to do better, but she's cautious around other boys. And given what happened, the family's in a tough position because they're still a military family and their livelihoods depend on the military. And I asked the mom about that specifically.
Has this changed your view of schools or even the view of the military?
The view of the military a lot. I feel that they don't put families first as much as they like to say so. There's not things in place for families to be supported in situations like this.
And that probably has to be pretty difficult.
Absolutely.
For you to say.
Yeah. I mean, it's my husband's career. It's, you know, our livelihood, and to have very little faith in basically a big chunk of our lives is really sad.
Justin, I want to turn back to you. You've talked to people who've worked in the military justice system. What did they tell you?
They're frustrated. They see the problem. They want change. Some have specific cases that may be years old that still haunt them. To this day, the fact that they could not get justice for kids who are the children of their brothers and sisters in arms. These are the people who they live with and train with and in some cases fight with.
All these schools fall under the authority of the Defense Department. So what did the officials there tell you?
The Pentagon spoke on behalf of its school system and said that student safety is a top priority. Even before publication, they did acknowledge some of the problems that we uncovered, and we'll have to see whether they match the words with any changes in action. In terms of the Pentagon more generally, in other words, parts of bases that are not the schools, we've had a heck of a time trying to get answers from the Pentagon on these types of issues, the lack of prosecution, the lack of support. And in some ways, it's been reminiscent of what the families say they face when these things happen to their children. I just think you shouldn't have to be an investigative reporter to get answers to what's happening when it comes to the safety and well-being of your children.
Justin Pritchard and Reese Dunklin of the Associated Press. Thanks for taking the time to talk to me, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Hal.
Well, the response to the AP's new investigation from lawmakers has been sharp and swift. Late this week, leaders from the Senate Armed Services Committee, John McCain and Jack Reed, called on the Pentagon to begin a comprehensive assessment of policies related to sexual assaults among military kids. Another senator, Kirsten Gillibrand, asked the Justice Department to investigate how federal prosecutors are handling these cases. So, how can you get a school to pay attention to this kind of violence? We go to one in Oklahoma, where students made the difference.
It was a time when we really wanted to say something, to step out and say, we are making a statement.
This is Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. Today, we're taking another look at a show we first brought you last year. We teamed up with the Associated Press on a really unsettling topic, sexual assault among kids. The show is not appropriate for all listeners. Now, when you hear these stories, you think, what can we do? Well, Reveal's Catherine Miskowski visited one school in Oklahoma where students found a way to fight back.
It's Thursday afternoon at Norman High School, and students are rushing to class. I'm plastered up against a locker as the crowds surge by. The weekend's coming, and students are making plans. By Monday, photos and videos passed around will fuel the week's gossip. That's one way what happens off campus can become the school's problem.
I think there was a time, maybe 30 years ago, where you'd say, well, you know, that happened on Saturday. We're not in school on Saturday. It's not really our concern. Those days are gone.
That's former district superintendent Joe Siano. In 2014, something happened off campus after a weekend party that changed this school. This next part is pretty disturbing. A male student didn't just rape a girl. He shot video during the assault and circulated it.
And then she just received a lot of ridicule for that.
That's Danielle Brown, who was a sophomore at the time. The school suspended the attacker for the rest of the academic year, but his friends were still at Norman, and the video was still out there. The victim felt bullied. After one student hassled her and she fought back, the school suspended her. She ended up transferring to another school. The assault and its aftermath disgusted Danielle.
She is the same age as me, so I mean, knowing that that could have been me or any of, like, anybody else.
Danielle is hardly your classic activist.
I mean, I am a very quiet person, a very introverted person.
But she and her friends wanted to protest, to support the victim and demand their school do more for students who'd been assaulted.
I was the one that knew that we probably needed adults with us because, I mean, I was 15 at the time. It was a bunch of sophomores and juniors.
She got in touch with Stacy Wright, her aunt, who lives blocks from Norman High. Stacy's first move was to activate her feminist knitting circle.
A group of women that get together and work on crafts and just talk about our lives and the ills of the world and support each other. And
Danielle often shows up at those meetings, too.
And I told her to invite the young woman and her mother to knitting circle and to have them, you know, just come and if they wanted to share their story and we would figure out what to do. We got together that night, and I don't think that any of us were even really prepared for the horror of what this young woman had been through.
Plans for the protest started to shape up. The students figured they'd go to school, then a few minutes into first hour, walk out. They came up with the hashtag YesAllDaughters to represent the idea that assault could happen to any of them. That turned out to be true. More girls from Norman High School came forward. Teens who said the same student had attacked them, too. His name was Tristan Kilman Hardin.
They had been isolated and bullied out.
That's Danielle Brown again.
And they hadn't been going to school, and they hadn't been getting any support.
Until the protests got going.
As soon as I saw the Yes All Daughters walk out thing on Facebook, I couldn't hold it in anymore.
That's Harper, not her real name. She says Tristan assaulted her too.
It happened in a restroom on campus, she remembers. They'd been dating, but they broke up after Tristan got violent.
He started spreading rumors about me, sending pictures around of me that I didn't even know were taken of me. Then the bullying started. I ended up getting, I don't want to say I got jumped, but a girl pretty much beat me up because of all the rumors that were going around. I left the school right after that. I didn't go back. I felt like I couldn't go back.
Harper felt isolated, ostracized even. Hearing about the protest changed that.
There's going to be this walkout because this happened. And I'm like, well, that also happened to me. So maybe I should talk to somebody now. Like, it's been a while. Maybe I should talk to somebody because I feel like I can talk to somebody now.
The day before the walkout, the school district was on high alert. In a letter, the superintendent told parents he'd excuse absences during first hour. But he added, "We do not know who will be in charge of tomorrow's event." That day, Danielle told her English teacher that she was.
And I told her, I was like, "I'm one of the organizers for this movement and I'm walking out today." And then I just stood up and left, and a bunch of students were with me, I think 600.
Danielle's aunt, Stacy, stood outside, watching students leave the building.
So they walked out, and it felt like that stream of students would never end. They just kept coming and coming and coming out the door, and I was standing there with the victims, and I'm gonna cry at this point. And one of them said, "I didn't think anybody cared." Sorry.
Harper watched, too, as all those students walked toward her.
It was probably the best feeling of my life. That just made me feel like I had, like, an even bigger group of people that were here for me.
Protesters waved signs that said, "Transfer is not the answer," and "Education, not revictimization." One woman's sign read, "She's my daughter." The action went on for hours. And quiet, introverted Danielle, there she was, yelling slogans into a bullhorn. With her mother and aunt, she delivered a list of demands to the principal of Norman High. Later that day, Harper and Tristan's other victims bonded, away from the crowds and the signs and the news cameras.
After the protest, I feel like everyone just kind of felt like they could let it go for a minute. We all went to go get our nails done together, and all of us girls like to sing, and so we're just sitting in the nail salon. We're all singing, and the ladies are like, "Come on, let's do it. You're so good."
The walkout even inspired one protester to compose an anthem. Hey, Honey, Hey.
It was a time when we really wanted to say something, to step out and say, we are making a statement.
That's Sophia Babb. Her twin sister Grace wrote the song, and they perform it together in their band, Annie Oakley.
Hey, honey, don't you know that no does not mean no.
Eventually, Tristan Kilman Harden went to prison for the rape that sparked the walkout. Three of his victims sued the school district, claiming it displayed deliberate indifference to plaintiffs' rights to a public education. They settled.
In 2017, I met District Superintendent Joe Ciano at his office just weeks before he'd retire. He says what happened at Norman High taught the district a lot. Most importantly, that when sexual violence happens, schools should always remember this.
A student was traumatized regardless of all of the issues around it, and you have to deal with the trauma first.
The district created new full-time positions to do just that, the student advocacy coordinators.
At both of our high schools and now expanded to our middle schools.
The advocates make sure students who've been victims of sexual assault, trauma, harassment, or bullying get the help they need.
The students are using the abacus. The high schools are probably two of our busiest positions. Every day they're busy.
Problems still happen.
I don't know that any district can be held accountable to make sure nothing ever happens. I think you have to mitigate and minimize these things.
In 2016, another case shook the school district. Two boys reported that teammates sexually assaulted them on a wrestling team trip. The victims were 16 and 12 at the time. One of their parents sued the district.
I think the things that we learned from the other situation played out exactly the way they should in that. The primary focus was the students who came forward and were victimized, and then we dealt with all the other pieces after that.
I asked Harper how she felt when she heard about the wrestling team.
Even though the whole situation was terrible, it kind of eased my mind a little bit to know, like, they're going to be able to talk to someone, and they're going to be able to find help, and this isn't something that's just under the rug anymore. Like, Yes All Daughters made it easier for them to talk about what had happened to them.
That piece was reported and produced by Catherine Miskowski, and she joins me in the studio now. Hey, Catherine.
Hi, Al.
So in Norman, there was a crisis, and the school district actually reacted to that. The question I had is, do you think that the school district would have done anything if the kids hadn't done the protests?
You know, I think that's really impossible to say, but I think we can give the students a lot of credit for putting this issue on the absolute top of the agenda. Because they did this walkout, they showed that this was really important to hundreds of students, and the administrators responded to that.
As good as it was, that was actually reactive, though, right? Like, the violence had to happen, and this is the aftermath and response to it. But you've gone out and talked to some schools that are actually trying to get ahead of it.
There are some school districts in Oregon that are trying to approach this really in a different way. Instead of being focus so much on the victim, they're actually trying to prevent the violence in the first place. And the way they're attempting to do that is by identifying kids who have some kind of troubling sexual behavior that they're exhibiting at school. And I went to Newport, Oregon to try to find out more about these efforts.
I know.
I'm at a beachfront Best Western, but where I am, there's no view of the waves. In a windowless conference room with people who work with juvenile sex offenders. From around the state, they've come for presentations on topics like sexual consent, a multidimensional approach. This talk is about pornography addiction.
You know, I remember when I was like 13 years old, my cousins and I found a Playboy.
Wilson Kenny leads the session.
It was like, oh my God, this is amazing, you know, and it was like a sacred document. We'd pass it from one, you know, and this is a thing that like I treasured for years, and it's so different now, right? Because you can go online and not just find like a Playboy, but like you can find the most graphic.
Wilson's a father of four and a psychologist. For an expert in sexual misconduct, he's surprisingly optimistic.
So how much?
He has a disarming ability to talk without getting embarrassed about topics many of us would prefer not to think about. Here's the title of his book, Sexual Misconduct in Children. Wilson thinks schools can do more to identify kids early on who have problems with their sexual behavior. He's helped some school districts in Oregon do that. At his porn talk, a school psychologist from one of those districts pipes up.
Shelly.
I have some anecdotal information about that.
Oh, good.
But the problem is we're seeing a lot of issues in the high schools of kids sharing information because they think, like, hey, isn't this cool? Look at this photo of my girlfriend.
Performing a sex act.
And yet it's not necessarily in their mind to do harm because they're like, hey, buddy, look at what.
Right.
Look what, you know, like, cool, look at me.
That's Shelley Rutledge with Salem-Keizer School District, about 50 miles south of Portland.
Yeah, you know, it's the modern, I think about like, you know, having been an adolescent male, it's the locker room talk of like, hey, you won't believe what happened last night, only now there's a photo. Yeah. I never did that, by the way, either. But I knew guys.
The sex act selfie is a new wrinkle on an old problem for schools. How to handle concerning sexual behavior. The kind of stuff that makes adults cringe.
Can you talk about, like, how have schools dealt with these kinds of behaviors in the past?
Generally through freaking out. Most commonly what happens is people just want to sweep things under the rug, right? I used to joke, if I could teach administrators to say penis and vagina comfortably, I'd be out of work. Because really a lot of it is being able to be comfortable having a sexual discussion with a family and a child about something that's going on. It's hard.
It is. Still, Wilson advises school officials to respond to this behavior frankly and systematically, starting as early as elementary school.
Most inappropriate sexual behavior that occurs like prior to age 13, most of that is not going to be picked up by the criminal justice system. And so what that means is that a lot of concerning sexual behaviors are just not being addressed by anyone anywhere.
At this point, you're probably thinking, elementary school? Come on. Little kids do inappropriate things because they don't know what's appropriate yet.
Let's say you've got a kindergartner who is, rubbing their genitals against a desk chair. That's a pretty common thing you run into in kindergartens.
If a teacher tells the child that's not okay, and the kid stops doing it, problem solved. But what if
you've said, please knock it off, and the behavior continues?
That's when you really have a problem. Wilson figures a school district with 40,000 kids may face 150 to 200 cases a year like this, that require a more calculated response. That means more than disciplining the child or phoning home. Wilson's approach activates a whole team to try and figure out what's going on.
The biggest fear that parents have when they come into those meetings is that someone is going to tell them their child is a pedophile, right? It's horrifying to think about that, right? And that doesn't occur in those meetings, and that's not the purpose of those meetings.
The purpose, he says, is to better understand the behavior and figure out how to keep it from happening again. That might mean more supervision for this student, on the playground, in the hallways, in the bathroom. Ideally, this would protect other students from future harassment or abuse, the school district from liability, and the kid in trouble from being labeled an offender. The Forest Grove School District outside Portland started using Wilson's approach in 2017. Administrators on the district's Sexual Incidents Response Committee gather in a conference room for a monthly meeting.
They didn't confirm, but I'm assuming Vicky will be here because of...
This is what they call a level two meeting, where the team deals with more serious cases and includes outside experts.
I'm hoping that Vicky shows up because of the case that I want to review today.
Right.
To shield the privacy of the students involved, the committee wouldn't let us sit in on most of this meeting. But in an interview, one former member told us how it's going.
I think it's changed the way that we as administrators view sexualized behavior.
Tammy Irian helped start the program at Forest Grove when she was an assistant principal there.
I feel like it's taken the burden of investigating and thoroughly processing those situations off of just one individual.
Administrators say they're happy to share that burden. There is no denying it can be tough to talk with parents about this stuff, especially if their child has done something to another child.
I think you can have that conversation in a very caring way with parents to say, you know, this is really an opportunity for us to provide support for your son or daughter. It's not just about protecting the victim. It's really about providing supports for the student, the offender.
Tammy says figuring out what the right supports are means asking a lot of uncomfortable questions.
We ask parents if the students have ever been exposed to, you know, highly sexual behavior in their past? Have they ever witnessed or been, you know, sexually abused, domestic violence in the home? We'll ask about if they've ever seen their child use coercion to get what they want.
Then the team tailors a plan to fit the offense. That may be as simple as making sure a teacher keeps an eye on a student's screen.
This is a pretty common one. Students who are, you know, inappropriately accessing pornography, we have to have teachers always in view of what a student is viewing.
Or the plan can be more elaborate, like making sure a victim and an offender are not in the same classes. In Forest Grove, it's too early to know if the new approach is working. Honestly, the public may never know. People of every age underreport sexual harassment and assault. Plus, school districts closely guard information about sexual misbehavior because minors and the district's reputation are involved. Nobody wants to be the Sandy Hook of sexual misconduct.
How would you judge the effectiveness of the approach?
Here's Wilson Kenny again.
That's really hard to do, right? Because you can't evaluate the disaster that you thwarted. There's no way to get at that, right? It's like, I think maybe the best you can do is, you know, by figuring out, you know, how many lives you're able to touch.
That's more than many school districts have been willing to do.
I have tried to remind people that this is nothing new.
Most adults can probably remember incidents from their own childhoods that everyone just tried to pretend weren't happening.
Think back to your elementary school and middle school days. We can remember the weird thing that happened at school, the person who seemed to have problems with their sexual behavior that no one did anything about. So this isn't a problem with which we're unfamiliar. It's one we've tried to forget about because it's unpleasant.
We know this is a tough topic, and it's hard to hear these kinds of stories. So thank you for listening. And if you're left wondering what you can do, we've got the AP's list of suggestions and more stories from this investigation all on our website, revealnews.org. Michael Montgomery was our lead producer this week, with producers Amy Walters and Catherine Miskowski. Sunduja Ragarajan assisted with the data reporting. Our show was edited by Cheryl Duvall. Special thanks to Associated Press editor Maud Bielman and reporters Gillian Flackus and Emily Schmall. Our sound design team is the dynamic duo, Jay Breezy, a.k.a. Mr. Jim Briggs, and Fernando, my man, yo, Aruda. They had help from Claire Mullen and Catherine Raimondo. Amy Powell is our editor-in-chief. Krista Scharfenberg is our acting CEO. Our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camerado, Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reeve and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Edson, and remember, there is always more to the story.